I said, I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. I'm neither proud of it, nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. This is one of the easiest things I say. I'm an alcoholic. But until something happened to me, I couldn't say that. Not even to myself. This was something nobody must know, not even me. And I went to any length to keep anybody from knowing it, including myself. So something has to happen before we can say I'm an alcoholic. If any one of you had called me an alcoholic 30 years ago, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I'd have kicked you right in the mouth if I could have seen you. But something happened to me in January 1946. And I could say I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had to have a drink or pill since. Something over 9,500 days without a drink or pill. By the grace of God, through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm one who believes that something has to happen to you and to me before we can fulfill the conditions for sobriety. One of two things has to happen, I think. Either we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, and that's the way it happened to me, or we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Or we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. We can't do them. We're a peculiar breed of cats. We can't hear till we can hear, and we can't see till we can see. Now let's look at that for half a minute. People come to this program who can't hear, I mean physically can't hear, and get sober and stay sober. We had an old boy out in San Diego that came to this program for 17 years or so and died sober, and he couldn't hear a thing. People come to this program that can't understand the language. And they get sober and stay sober. We got an old boy up in Santa Barbara. He happens to be Mexican. He came to the program, a Mexican wino, with 13 kids. So he wasn't drunk all the time. And he couldn't even understand English. But he got sober and stayed sober. Right off the bat, he got sober and stayed sober. I talked at his 10th birthday. He's now past 20 years. And he got up there and he says, I'm better educated than your speaker. He says, I can speak two languages and he can only speak one. Because he had gone back to school. And he'd graduated from high school. After coming to the program and getting sober and already having 13 kids. So, he heard without hearing and did and stayed sober. People come to the program that physically cannot see and they get sober and stay sober. Somebody told me down in Louisiana the other day, I was down there eating crawdads. And they had several hundred people at the meeting. And they told me that 30%, 33% of the people in that group could neither read nor write. I didn't think there would be an audience in the United States where 30%. 33% couldn't read or write. But that's what you told me about this gun. And there were only a half a dozen blacks in the whole crowd. These were white folks. And they could neither read nor write. And it's one of the real great AA weekends. They were talking and living, the best AA you ever saw. So, many of us, you and me, cannot hear and cannot see, although we have ears and eyes. For instance, until I had run out of time, people, places, things, health, sanity, and choice, I couldn't even come to this program. I couldn't even investigate it. As long as I had choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never came, as long as I had the power of choice. So those of you who still have choice, don't be discouraged. There's a line in our book that says that. Don't be discouraged, but I don't think it means just what I'm about to say. I'm telling you to don't be discouraged. Keep on nipping that flit, and the time will come when you ain't got no choice. This will be the only place left that you can go. And it's surprising how easy it is to come here when there's no place else to go. Now, again, just for fun. 3 months before I came calling into this program, on my next to the last trip, I made a 6,000-mile journey, automobile trip, in a blackout. I don't recommend it. I drove from Beverly Hills, California, to Louisville, Kentucky, to North Michigan, and back to the coast. And I don't remember 5% of it. The 5% of it that I remember is very interesting, but I'm not going to tell you. Because I ain't got time. But I eventually got back to the coast, and I went to bed to finish my drunk. I finished all of my drunks in bed the last 10 years. And I never got out of bed for any other purpose than to replenish my supply. And I can tell you, good people, that there are other reasons to get out of bed. I never quit while I could get another supply. But when the time came that I was out of liquor and out of strength, and Mrs. C'd have to lift my head off the pillow, put a little liquid in my mouth, I couldn't even roll over to see if there's a bottle under the bed, I would have to quit, and that time came. And maybe 24, 36 hours after my last drink, I was able to go to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk, which I did. Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a yell, and they heard me hit the floor. And they came trotting out, they tell me, expecting to find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my want. But I'd done run out of convulsions. I wasn't convulsing. I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a very peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. Now, as serious as this thing is, it just tickled the hell out of me. Because I'm mindful of the many, many times I came off a drunk in those last 10 years, to find that everybody in town was looking for me. 90% of them just to tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, why do they have to ferret us out, you know, to tell us they never want to see us again, I don't know. But they do. They always do. And my wife and kids had been praying for me to die for not less than 5 years. And they come to the kitchen and find me dead. And they get all exercised about it, you see? And they call the oxygen squad from the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. And they came down and worked me over. And I think they woke me up. I think they did. And I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with him. And he was telling me what had happened. And he told me that, to all intents and purposes, I'd been dead. That they'd had a rough time bringing me back. And it was their opinion that nobody would ever be able to bring me back again under those circumstances. And he very seriously told me that if he were me, he wouldn't do that anymore. I got the impression that they were against it. Well, it's another 24 or 36 hours, and I've gotten well enough to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking off this drunk. That's the only way I ever knew how to sober up. I never heard of a drying out place. And then I came to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never had to use it because I've never had to sober up since my first meeting. The only way I knew to sober up was to die until I could live. And I mainly did it walking. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. And that's what I'm doing. Living room, up and down the living room. We had a corner fireplace. Mrs. C was standing over the fireplace. And I'm walking away from her. And she says, "Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she might as well have hit me over the head with a ball bat. I turned on her like a lion. I said, "You, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks." "I have read all the good books for the good authors. And you want me, why?" I says, "You wound me deeply." I'd been dead, just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounds me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, "And besides, I can write a better book than that myself." Now, mind you, I'd been drinking 25 years. And this was just 90 days before I came crawling in here. This is what I'm talking about. There was no way under heaven that I could get any help because I could not hear and I could not see. So something has to happen to us before we can get any help. And those of us who are working with alcoholics must see this, or they'll kill us. They'll kill us if we don't see this. We've got to give them the right to make their own mistakes. I'm one who believes that it is not within my scope to deny the alcoholic his right to suffer. Because something's got to happen. And with some of us, the only way it can happen is by suffering. You get an alcoholic that might be just about ready to go to headquarters for a little help. And give him a $20 bill, and he ain't got no problems anymore. His problems are solved. Till the 20's gone. We got to recognize the need for help before we can get it. And that's why in our third chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. To fully concede to our innermost selves. Now, why should this be the first condition for sobriety? And be way back there in chapter 3. 12 steps are in chapter 5, the program of recovery. And this is back in chapter 3. Why? Because you and I, if we be alcoholic, are caught in a trap we cannot spring. We have to have help. And we can't get it until we recognize the need for it. To accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now, is the first condition of recovery. For instance, again, I drank for 25 years. And up until my last drunk to date, it was never my fault that I drank. Never. It was your fault. If you stupid people had lived like I knew you should and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had to drink. But you wouldn't do it, so I got drunk at you. I had a perfectly legitimate reason for every drunk I was ever on till my last one. My wife, many of you know her. She was a good excuse. Reason, I mean, not excuse. And while she was very good as an excuse, her mother was much better. Now, there was a king-size excuse to drink. She had only one kid, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. She hadn't been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. We had a mutual hating society that was a beautiful thing to behold. But I have to tell you that she lived with us 5 years after I got sober. And it is absolutely amazing what this program did for her. They should have come through that same living room in the last year she lived and found me slapping that daughter of hers all over the living room. She'd have said, "Why, Elsa, what have you done?" By this time, I could do no wrong. My boss was a fantastic reason for me to get drunk. It was obvious to me that I had all the brains in the organization. And he had all the money. And the very injustice of the situation. Make anybody get drunk. So up until my last drunk, it was never my fault. My last drunk, I came to see that if there be fault, it's mine. And I've never had to drink anymore. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. God can't even help us until we will allow him to. So, that last excuse has got to go to the boards. One of our beloved guys in this area went home before this meeting. He knew I was going to talk. So he beat it back to Dallas. And he tells a story that tickles me. He says that these two drunks met on the street. And one of them says the other, "How stinks?" And he says, "Not good." Well, he says, "That's bad." Or he says, "Not so bad, I got married." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, I got my mother-in-law, too." But he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, she's got money." He says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, she wants to boss everything." Well, he says, that's bad. He says, "Not so bad, since she bought us a house." Well, he says, "That sure is good." He says, "Not so good, brother, since the house burned down." But he says, "That sure is bad." He says, "Not bad, she burned, too." I'll write that down for you, Steve. Now, that last excuse has got to burn up. It's got to go. If you and I have one excuse left that is still acceptable to us, we have another drunk left. Because no man is going to do the things necessary to bring about sobriety as long as he can pin this deal on anything else at all. So the first condition for sobriety is to accept ourselves as we are where we are. Now, the second is that sobriety must come first. Sobriety must come first. And this is awful hard for us to see, and it's much harder for our mates to see, those around us. The non-alcoholic who's lived with us, mine for 20 years. True, she was getting rid of me legally 26 years ago. But she'd lived with me for 20 years. And I come to this program. And I'm fairly busy after I get here. Because I came often and stayed late. Because I wanted this thing more than life. And after 6 months of a meeting every night, with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have this thing, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been for 6 months. All the time, I'd been sober. And it was quite a discovery. And it was then I started talking. And I haven't shut up yet. And amongst those to whom I talked was my wife. Now, I hadn't told her anything about this program at all. Matter of fact, I hadn't told her anything. We weren't communicating to a third party, you know. But I had to talk, and I talked to her about this program. And I found that she'd already read my book about three or four times. And she asked me to take her to meetings. And I did. And she's still going with me. But anyway, maybe it's 4 months later. I may have been 10, 11 months in the program. And I was asked to do a 10-minute talk before the regular speaker in the Beverly Hills group. That was my home group. And I did. And I ended the little talk by saying, if it were necessary for me tonight to go to Tibet to maintain what I found here, I would go home, pack my little grip, come through the living room, kiss my wife, and say, honey, it's too bad, I've got to go. Now, I didn't think that was bad. Until about 30 minutes after we got home. And I'm sitting there, and I feel the old house start rocking. And I look over, and my wife is almost in convulsions. She's just crying her eyes out. And I said, well, honey, what's the matter? She says, oh, what you said. She says, for the first time in 20 years, we have a chance to have a little peace and joy and happiness in this household. And you'd go to Tibet. She says, don't I mean anything to you? Don't the children mean anything to you? Don't the home mean anything to you? Boo-hoo. And I let her cry until she calmed down a little. And I says, honey, do I mean anything to you drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to the kids drunk? No. Anything to the home drunk? She says, no. Do I mean anything to me drunk? And she says, no. And I said, well, can't you see this has to come first? And she couldn't. That is not easy. But the wonder of this thing lies right here. When you're willing to go, you don't have to. It's becoming willing that's the deal. Now, I've been willing to go to Tibet to maintain this thing for 26 years and 3 months. And I never even had to go to Watts. it's awful hard to see. Now, there's a little verse, and I shouldn't quote verses, but I do. And it's not because I want to prove to you how many verses I know, but because verses, in so many instances, say what I want to say better than I can say it. I got a doctor at home who looks at me and he says, I hate people that quote verses. I said, hate me, brother. There's a little verse that says, lest a man be willing to leave his mother and his father and his wife and his kids, sell all he has and give it to the poor, and take up his cross and follow me. He's not worthy of me. Now, for the 30 years prior to the time I came to this program, I would have argued with the Pope in Rome and the entire College of Cardinals that the carpenter didn't say that. I knew he didn't. Because he was a good man. He couldn't have said that. I was an evil man, and I couldn't say it, so I knew he couldn't. What cad is going to leave his wife and his kids, and you know? So I knew he didn't say it. It was either a deliberate attempt to deceive or a mistranslation. But I wasn't sober more than 5 years anyway, when I knew that if he didn't say it, he should have. Because all in the world that means is that my own peace of mind and serenity of purpose cannot depend on any person, place, thing, circumstance, or condition out there. It depends only on my own relationship with my very own God. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Now that's all in the world, that means. So, it's hard to come to see that sobriety must come first. But I am one who believes that unless and or until it comes first, we can't have it. And unless it remains first, we cannot keep it. Because otherwise we will not do the things that are necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. Because they're absolutely a reversal of our thought and action pattern in our entire life up until the time we come here. It is just exactly like I'd walked straight north for 43 years, made a 180-degree turn, and walked south for 26. That's the difference in life. And you can't do it. We alcoholics can't do it unless we have it done for us, as I did, or come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Now, fortunately for me, I never had to surrender consciously the first time. And I say fortunately for me because I couldn't have done it. There was no way that I could surrender. No way. The word was not even in my vocabulary. So the first time, the bottle did it for me. It killed me. It beat me and total and absolute nothingness. And I came to the program surrendered. Thank God. Now, I've had to surrender many, many times since, consciously. But the first time it's done for me. And when I got here, everything in Chapter 5 was something I wanted to do. Everything was something I wanted to do. And I know that it was because of the total state of abandonment of self in which I got here. Now, to make it a little simple, because we, I believe, make it awful hard on ourselves, to make it a little simple, I did not abandon myself to God. I did not abandon myself to this simple program. I did not know this simple program. I had made it my business not to know anything about it. And I couldn't abandon myself to God because I didn't think it was cricket even to believe that I could give this mess, that was made to anybody, much less to God. So I abandoned myself to nothing, which is the same thing. All we need is to abandon ourselves, and the roadblock is gone. So, when I got the program, the one thing that I couldn't do was take step three. All the rest of them were pretty nice. But step three I couldn't do, not because I didn't want to. I would have turned my will and my life over to a jackass if I could have gotten rid of me, you know. But I wouldn't have taken me with a large dowry. And I didn't figure God would either. So I just let that lay. And I took off with the last third of 12 when the time came. Practiced these principles in all of our affairs. And later on discovered the fact that I already had taken the third step before I got here. I had completely abandoned myself to nothing. Now, I wanted this morning to give you the United States version of the 12 steps. That Canadian honker got up here and goofed them all up the other night. And I thought I should straighten you out. But I'm not going to do it. I'm going to just talk a little bit around it and then talk about something else. You know, the first step in the program is a twofold admission of defeat. Now, that's why these other two things have to come before the step number one. That sobriety comes first and that we accept ourselves as we are. Because otherwise, we could not take that first step. It's a twofold admission of defeat. I'm powerless over alcohol, physical. My life's unmanageable, mental. I've lost the battle of life twice over. Now, that's not easy for an alkie, you know. You're not just going to run into the bar and say, look, Joe, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. Give me a double. Quick. You're not going to do that. By this time, you've got to go in and start building an image for that bartender. You got to tell him about your good fortune. You just made a big merger. Sold a railroad, you know. Built him all up because after the fourth drink, you've got to discover you forgot your pocketbook. So you're certainly not going to admit to him that you've lost the battle of life. But that's where we start. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. A twofold admission of defeat. The second one, a left-handed admission that we're nutty as a fruitcake. First step, we've lost the battle. Second step, we're insane. Now, that's pretty fast going for a drunk, isn't it? Huh? Right off the bat. Lost the battle of life and nuts. Second step says we came to believe that far greater results could restore us to sanity. Now, there's an implication here. You don't have to restore a sane person to sanity, you know. It's not necessary. So if we need to be restored to sanity, we're nuts. And that's only the second. Third one's worse than both of them. Because the third one says you got to turn over the keys. You got to turn over the keys. Now, there's only one way that anybody ever devised to get my keys. That was to wait till I passed out. I could come out of a pub at 3 o'clock in the morning with my wife or yours. and we'd head for the parking lot. And she'd say, honey, give me the keys, I'll drive. You'd say, whose car? This is my car. If you're going with me, get in. I'm driving. Now, you might be there till daylight. You ain't gone to no place. But you've still got the keys. Step number three says you got to get a new driver. We made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. Now, this is not alcoholic thinking. Just the reverse. And, of course, something has to happen before we can do it. This is the reason we talk a little bit about our problem, as it's known to, say, medical science. When I came to my first meeting, I came alone. I never had a sponsor. The meeting was on the ground floor. I disguised myself as much as I could because I didn't think that it might be a good thing to be seen going into places that are occupied by people like you. So I put on the two good garments that I had. Camel's hair, gray camel's hair coat with a belt around the middle and a big collar. And I pulled that collar up around my head. And I had a hat with a very wide brim on it. Most of you have seen it for years. I still wear it in cold weather. And I put that hat on and I pulled that thing down over my face and sallied forth. And I got there about maybe 10 minutes before the meeting started. And I stood in the doorway and I looked at you. And with my keen alcoholic mind, it didn't take me very long to see that they'd given me the wrong information. Because there were about 40 people in there. And they didn't look like me and they weren't dressed like me. And they most certainly didn't feel like me. Because they're all standing in there in the middle of the room yakking. Yak, 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 yak. Nobody listening. Everybody talking. And, of course, I knew that these were the veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. Because this was veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. They'd given me the wrong information and like to kill me. Because at long last, I'd come. And it was the wrong night. And I was a living dead man for sure when I turned to leave. Now, this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in the next minute. This is it. Without this, no recoveries at all. None. Somebody inside had been watching. And when I started to leave, he ran over the door. And he called to me. And he says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. Well, he says, what were you looking for? And I said, it was interesting, sir. I was looking for a sobriety because I thought he was better. And with that, he lit up like a Christmas tree. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. You see, it was obvious that this guy was glad I was there. And I was no bargain. I just come off of a 4 weeks blackout, drunk. And to this guy, I was really a bargain. He lit up like a Christmas tree. And when he opened his mouth, he says, why, take off your hat and coat, you're in the right place. Now, this is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous right now. He took me in and rocked me to sleep. Without this, no recoveries. This is the reason this thing works when nothing else in the world does. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another. Sharing, caring and sharing is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what they did. And they took me in there and they told me a few things that I've never forgotten. They told me that if I were an alcoholic, one drink was too many and 1,000 weren't enough. They said it's first drink that's killing you. Now, I'd only drunk 25 years, so that's not very long. But nobody had ever told me it was the first drink that's killing me. Nobody. No doctor, priest, preacher, psychiatrist had ever told me it's the first drink that's killing me. And I'd never told myself, because I was periodic for the last 10 years. And periodics don't get drunk in a hurry. There's no way that we could figure out that it was the first drink. Periodics taper on. They never taper off. Now, for my last 10 years, my job was not the first drink. It was the last gallon. What I was trying to do was find a way to cut it off before the trouble started, you know? And I got here, and these monkeys says it's the first drink. It's killing you. And I played with it a while and bought it, because I could see it was just a question of time from that first slug after a dry spell. And I was physically as sober as them tonight between every two drunks for 10 years, the last 10. It was just a question of time from that first slug till I was flat on my back drinking the clock around again. So I bought it. The second thing they told me, and this is a sneaky way to keep you coming back, the second thing they said was, today is the day we don't drink. Isn't that something? Today is the day we don't drink. Now, they'd have told me I had to be sober 26 years or drop dead. Hell, nobody ever stayed sober 26 years. 26 days was without, there was no reason that could even settle for 26 days. But they didn't say that. They said, today is the day we don't drink. Now, if a day is too long, how about an hour? How long can you live without a drink? Put your life on that basis. Live that long and don't drink and start over. But, said they, no matter how many years you live in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will not change that time to include more than 24 hours. One day at a time. It's as long as you live. About that. And I've lived it that way for 26 years. I never worked for birthday. I never worked for next Tuesday. Today is my day. I have no past. I want no future. Surprising how easy life is when you do it one day at a time. Now, of course, in the beginning, it was for sobriety only. But by the time I woke up the fact I was sober, I was used to doing it in everything I did. And it's been one day for everything since. And I highly recommend it. If there's one thing I wish that you might all take home with you, those of you who haven't done it, is that you leave every yesterday in this room when you go home. Leave every yesterday that you ever lived in this room when you go, when you leave. And every tomorrow. Because the combined intelligence of the human race can't change one thought or act of yesterday. And tomorrow isn't even ours. God's. 99% of our trouble is yesterday's burdens and tomorrow's fears. And when you haven't got either one of them, you're home free. Fantastic. Now, the next thing they told me is stay close to us. Get into as many meetings as you can, said they. And I bought that. Said they, there's more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than in any other room on the face of the earth, except another room just like this, where members of Alcoholics Anonymous are meeting. Get into as many meetings as you can. And I did. And I am. I've averaged near 5 and 4 meetings a week for 26 years. And I've never attended one too many. You know, you hardly ever see anybody get drunk in an AA meeting. Hardly ever. So, I'll be coming to these meetings till you pat me in the face with the scoop. Now, many of you might have heard me say this. It doesn't happen too long ago, but some of you pretty likely didn't. But I was talking to a guy that's about my age in this program not long ago. And he said to me, "Chuck," he says, "I'll quit working with wet drunks." He says, "I've done my part of that, and I'm tired of them puking on me." He says, "How about you?" I said to him, "Well, you do as you like. But I'm going to keep right on going, just like I am. Because I'd a hell of a lot rather be the pukee than the puker." And then he told me why I couldn't drink like other people. The reason I can't drink like other people is because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. I've never heard that before in my life. Nobody had ever mentioned the disease of alcoholism to me until I came here. But I've remained with you to find that informed medical opinion classifies alcoholism as one of the top three killers in the country today. Some of them put it first. None of them put it more than fourth as a killer. It's second only to one of our social diseases, the cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's a matter of life or death, and it's my life. Now, the definition that came to us through a doctor, by a doctor, defines the disease as a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. It's both physical and mental, according to the doctor. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that for some reason unknown to anybody, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take a slug of liquor, I retain it, it goes into the bloodstream and the brain. And it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. Now, this is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor, and this is one of our greatest problems. We look around us and see people that are obviously our inferiors, drinking that flip and not getting into any trouble, you know? And we say to ourselves, "Why can't I drink? He does, and he ain't got it." And our answer is, "I can, and I got to prove it." I'm still trying to prove it 10 years after I've lost the battle. And I went to many places where they should have been able to help me. But in those days, prior to 26 years ago, almost nobody knew anything about the disease of alcoholism. They talked to me about willpower, backbone, stand up being a man. You know? They didn't know, and they couldn't help me, and I didn't know, and I couldn't help myself. So it's a good thing to know why we can't successfully drink. Now, if you and I could tell each other if we continued to drink, we'd end up alcoholics. Maybe we'd believe each other. But that's not true. Now, experts tell me that every user of dope over a period of time becomes an addict. Every one of them, 100%. But that's not true with us. Only 10% of us end up alcoholics. And there's no self-respecting alcoholic on earth who's going to put himself in the bottom 10%. If we can't operate in the top 5, we won't play. One of our great problems. But it's an awful good thing to know. Now, there are a couple of things about the physical side of the disease that we know about. We don't know what the physical difference is, so we don't spend any time on that. But a couple of the aspects of the physical part of the disease are most necessary for me to remember, keep uppermost in my consciousness all the time. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. There isn't a case in medical history where anybody like me ever returns successful drinking. I must keep that forever in the uppermost regions of my consciousness. Secondly, the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total abstinence. Now, this is tough for us to see. so tough. Because when we get a little distance between us and the jug, the old subconscious starts telling us you're building up some good drinking time. You're getting strong. You know, you're building up some good drinking time. There's no such thing as an alky building up good drinking time. I'm actually 26 years worse off so far as successful drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And I know it. And I don't have to take a drink to prove it. That's one of the greatest arguments for staying close to and being active in Alcoholics Anonymous that there is. Because all you got to do is to be in these meetings to keep your eyes open. Because your friends are forever taking that drink for you. You know. And if you watch them, you won't have to take it. You'll have to watch a bunch of them die, and you're not going to like that at all. Because many of them, you would rather die yourself. It's a bad old lesson, but it's very effective. I've never caught myself once in 26 years toying with the idea that I might handle a little light wine and beer. Not one time, because I know better. I know that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total absence. And lastly, the physical part of the disease is incurable. Some mutt out there at our place was standing up here talking to our group the other night, and he says, you know something? He says, if Howard Hughes was an alcoholic, he'd have to come to us for help. Isn't that something? Now, inasmuch as there's nothing we can do about the physical but accept it, we do that. And then turn to the other half of the disease. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. When the body's dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink is physical. But the first one is mental. And if you and I want to get rid of the bottle, we have to be rid of its cause. The obsessions of the mind. And that's what our program is all about. Now, the American Medical Association has said in recent months, alcoholism is a disease, it has symptoms, it is treatable but not curable. And the only way an alcoholic can successfully live is not to take that next drink. But they cannot tell us how not to take the next drink. They can't tell us. They can tell us not to take it, but they can't tell us how not to take it. But our program does. It gives us a formula that is absolutely foolproof. And all you and I must do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula. And something happens, and we don't have to drink it. Something happens, and we don't have to drink it. I told you, I was periodic for the last 10 years. I was physically as sober as I am tonight, between every two drunks. But I always drank again. Even looking at a record with physically sober eyes, I still got drunk again. When it came my time to drink, I got drunk. For 10 years. And I'd built up quite a record by that time. And it was all bad. I never had one good drunk in the last 10 years. But I kept trying. The obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. Now that's the reason I believe our book, when it says lack of power was our dilemma. And if we lacked the power, we had to find one. And it must be a power greater than we are, obviously, says the book. Obviously. And I believe it. The book says under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first slug. And that is help from a power greater than ourselves. And I believe it just as much as I believe I'm standing right here. And for just as simple a reason. If I could have remained sober, I wouldn't believe it. I could not remain sober, therefore I believe it. Because something happened 26 years ago, and I haven't had to have a drink or pill since. And I didn't do it. So So I believe that it's necessary that we have help from Thargator himself. But in the same breath, I say that I think one of the biggest hurdles we have as individual members of Alcoholics Anonymous is in our attempt to get that help from Thargator himself. Now, isn't that a terrible thing to say? But I believe it as much as I believe I'm here. Because, you see, I did not come to this program to find God. I did not come to this program to get my wife back. I did not come to this program to get the love of my kids back. I did not come to this program to get my job back or my health back. All of these things were gone and should be gone, and I knew it, and I wasn't even entitled to have them back, and I knew that. I came here hoping against hope that I might find a way to live that didn't include that first slug, to get rid of that flip. I had had it. And drunks just like you, who were not drunk, said to me, if you want these things, do these things. Here's the things we did, now do them. Do them to the best of your ability, one day at a time. And see what happens. And I didn't have any more sense than to do them. And I still haven't got any more sense than to do them. I'm still doing them. And I haven't had to have a drink or a pill. Now, a lot of other things have happened, too, that I wasn't working for. You know? So, my big hope is that we might quit hunting for God and do these things for sobriety. Because when we fulfill the conditions, we eventually wake up to the fact that the conditions for sobriety and the conditions for the good life and the conditions of God are all the same. They're all the same. And by doing them, things happen. And by not doing them, nothing happens. How many times have you heard, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't work for me? You know? Of course it didn't, and it never will. Alcoholics Anonymous is a formula. Formulas don't do anything. Recipes don't bake cakes. It's a way to bake a cake. This is the best formula that has ever been conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God for an alcoholic to obtain and maintain sobriety. If he does it for sobriety, but if he gets down to step three and says, uh-oh, no, wait a minute. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, and we understood him. Don't understand him. I got to get me another book. I got to get me a tutor. And they toot all over the place and still toot. Best way in the world to stay drunk is start interpreting the steps. You interpret and nip, and nip it, interpret and nip. And then you nip and don't interpret. Don't say, here are the steps we interpreted. Here are the steps we took. Of course, this again is what's wrong with this program. You and I know we're drunks. That line couldn't mean nothing. There's only one five-letter word in it. Here are the steps we took. Well, a drunk can read that and just pass it up. We like big words. If there were a couple of psychedelics in there, traumas, we've had a few traumas in there, you know. We stop and look at it, because those are big words. I don't know what they mean, but they're big words. But no, it says, here are the steps we took. So it don't mean nothing but life. That's all it means. Here are the steps we took. Now, when you and I get simple enough to took them, we're home free. And until we took them, nothing happens. Now I want to leave that lay and play a little while. You know, a lot of things happen to you as you go along in this society. Lately, we're getting lots and lots of youngsters in our program at home. Many, many youngsters. And I mean young. I sat in a meeting the other night with a kid 11 years old that had 40 days of sobriety. 11 years old. 40 days of sobriety. A confirmed alcoholic. Now, a lot of these kids tell me, how in the hell do you know how I feel? You know? You haven't had a drink for 26 years. You're too far away from it. You don't know how I feel. Well, I guess I know how I feel. Because, you see, I haven't quit working with wet drunks. There is no way that you can get any older than your last session with a wet drunk. That's as old as you are in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I'll never quit. Everything goes before you when you're working with a wet drunk. You know, every feeling that he has, every pain that he has, and every thought that's going through his mind. And it's just as fresh as yesterday, you know? People say to me, when do you think is a good time to take the fourth step? And I say, you done asked the wrong man. You asked the wrong man. Because I think the best time in the world to take the fourth step is when you've taken the first, second, and third. Right then is a beautiful time to take fourth. And you can't take fourth if you're taking one, two, and three. Because you're not that honest, you know. And then the fifth step. I get in bad every time I come down here. Because there's a lot of people in this part of the country that think you got to run every third Tuesday and take an inventory, fifth step. Fifth step all over again, you know. 2 years ago, I was riding someplace with somebody down here, and they told me they'd taken 26 fifth steps since January, and this was November. I said, what the hell are you trying to do? Kill yourself? I'm thoroughly convinced that anybody that takes the fifth step twice is bragging. A lot of people want to shoot me for that. Because they say, wait a minute, I wasn't honest enough to put it all down the first time. Of course you weren't. And you're not enough honest enough now to put it all down. And you're never going to be honest enough to put it all down. Because you can't think of it in one second. But again, if you're working with wet drunks, you're taking a continuous fifth step. And you don't even have to think about it. Because every session you're in, something new comes out. And you share it with the guy you're working with. And you're taking an everlasting fifth step. And you're not even thinking about it. You know? Now, I've been talking a great deal with the guy this weekend that thinks he has a hell of a problem in front of him. And he does if he keeps trying to do it. He does if he keeps trying to do it. If I'd have had to work out my defects of character one at a time, I'd have died 26 years ago. If I could work out my defects of character in the first place, I wouldn't have come here. I wouldn't need you. I wouldn't even need God if I could have worked out my life. I'm hired down someplace. I had to be hauled out. I had to be told for a while. Now, I don't read my book, but I have to go and beat my brains out over my defects of character. My book says we've made a searching and fearless moral inventory, writing it down. We write it down. We share it. And they give us a good push with a pitchfork. Because they say you got to share it with God and yourself and another human being. That's another bad thing they put in there. Well, I can get under the table here and share it with myself and God. But if I have to lay that dirty linen out before another human being, you know, that's a king-size ego buster. You got much ego left after that when you ain't done it. So you write it, you share it. You become willing to give it away and you give it away. You become willing to give it away and you give it away. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now that's the easy way to do it. The hard way is to beat yourself to death. I got a lot of work to do. I worked on my alcoholic problem for 10 years. The last 5 years, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. The more I looked at it, the bigger it grew. It was just like fertilizing, watering, and cultivating a weed. It grew out of all proportions. And it never quit growing until I quit looking at it. And started looking at and trying to live in this answer. And the problem disappeared, and I didn't even know when it left. The help is here when we do the thing for sobriety. So, let's not try to do this thing all by ourselves. Let's share it with our partner in the business of living. People say to me, great big tough men say to me, Chuck, when did you get rid of your fears? When did you get rid of your fears? And they're big tough guys. And you know, it's tough because I can't tell them. Because my fears died with me. My fears died with me 26 years ago. And I can't say, well, I'm different, you know. But I am. Not because I shook different or drank different, you know. Or sounded different when I was working out of set of dry heaves. I don't believe the neighbors have known whether it was me or you. Couldn't get here until the bottle had killed me. And I got here with no expectancy at all. No expectancy at all. I didn't expect nothing from nobody, no time. And I had 3.5 years of the most beautiful freedom that anybody ever heard tell of. A period of the greatest sequence of miracles that I ever lived through. Because every little piece of the jigsaw puzzle of life fell together in those 3.5 years. But something bad happened, too. Something bad happened. In that 3.5 years, I became somebody again. Yeah. That rights. And when you got rights, you got to defend them. And you're in trouble all over again. Our book tells us that the greatest obstacle you and I have as alcoholics is resentments. Resentments kill more people than anybody. Okay, says the book. But resentments don't come first. Rights come first. And so I had to start surrendering all over again, consciously, after 3.5 years. And this offered one of the great problems in my life. I couldn't understand how this damned ego came back after I'd been without it for 3.5 years, you know? And I looked at that for 12 years, and I could not find any reason for that ego to come back. And I had some pretty rough times. My 11th year was the worst year I ever lived, drunk or sober, because I had to lose and win in my 11th year when I was right, dead right. But I still had to lose and win. And if you think it's tough to lose and win when you're wrong, try it when you're right. Like it beat me to death. And I kept looking at this thing. Why does this have to happen? When I'd been totally free. And I was already 16 and a half years in this program. Before I came to see something good in the human ego. And I got an answer that's just as comfortable with me as an old pair of shoes. This is the burr under the saddle. This is the thing that keeps you and I walking. And after we've made a commitment, we have to keep walking. Life will not let us stop. We have to keep walking. So, this is the thing that keeps us walking. We get uncomfortable. And we, after a while, we get very sensitive to being uncomfortable. And we start having to look and find what we have allowed to get important enough to get between us and our program and our God. And we have to eliminate it through an additional surrender. The time will never come in my way of thinking when it won't be necessary for you and I to surrender. Continuously surrender. And we have to keep walking. Now, my last 10 years, along with my good wife, she's a non-alcoholic. She does lots of work with the Al-Anon. The last 10 years, the biggest part of our time has been spent with men and women from 10 to 25 years sober, who are exploding right in the middle of their skin. In my area, the man that's the oldest in the program, he's 32 years in the program, and I sat with him the other day on the bed. He says, "Chuck, I've given up." He says, "There's nothing to live for anymore." And he's 32 years in this program. God, this just kills me. This just kills me, you know. Because all we got to do is to surrender out of these things. Make them opportunities instead of crises. We surrender. We make that next surrender. And turn the crisis into an opportunity. And this has been necessary in my greatest activity in the last several years. You see, it don't make a damn bit of difference what happens to you or to me. It don't make a damn bit of difference what happens to you or to me. It's our reaction to what happens that kills us. If we don't react, nothing's happened. Nothing. And so it's necessary that we keep doing these things forever. For instance, I wish I had all day. What time is it? It's time I was quitting. I'd like to talk about this all day long. You see, one of these days we have to come to see that people don't act like they act because they want to at all, but because they have to. Now, every alcoholic in this room will quickly admit that he drank against his own will, that the obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. So we take unto ourselves the privilege of hiding behind obsessions of the mind. then we won't give them to the non-alcoholic world. They haven't got any right to have obsessions of the mind. They're not alcoholics. This is part of our disease. You know? But they have obsessions of mind just as we do. You know, the man never lived that hates me bad enough to want to tear me down. Never lived. There's nobody that thinks that much about you. One of the greatest things that ever came out in the grapevine was people wouldn't be so concerned about what other people think about them if they knew how seldom they did. Now, let me tell you what I'm talking about. 30 years ago, my wife says to me, "Chuck, why can't you drink like Ted?" Now, she oughtn't said that to me. Because she immediately gave me a project. It was absolutely necessary from that second forward for me to get old Ted falling down drunk in front of my wife. Now, I didn't dislike Ted. I loved him. He was not only one of my greatest friends, but he was my benefactor. His company fed me for 20 years. 40 years, actually. They were my best customers. We'd drunk together, gambled together, played, sang, and danced. And Ted was one of the best drinkers I ever saw. And still is. When he was loaded, he was perfect. He stood exactly correctly. He spoke precisely and with perfect English. Just before he'd fall on his face. But see, Ted wasn't an alcoholic. And I didn't want to get him drunk because I hated him. I love him. And always did. But hell, I couldn't let my wife think, "Why can't you drink like Ted?" So I had to get him drunk. Now, just to give you a little parallel to that. 2 years ago, I went from Laguna Beach to the Ohio Street group. Some of you have heard of Clancy. That's his hangout up there. And I went up there, and it was on a Saturday. And I'd been drinking coffee all day, and I got up there, and of course my first stop was the little boy's room. And there was a guy in the little boy's room, and he took a look at me, and he says, "Uh-oh." He says, "Are you speaking here tonight?" And I says, "Think I am." Well, he said, "I wish I'd known it, I'd have gone to Malibu." I said, "You still got time, and I got the money." I said, "You go out there in the hall and call a cab, and I'll pay your cab fare to Malibu and back. And there's going to be a good meeting up there. They always have a good meeting on Saturday night. So you run along up there, and I'll pay the cab fare." Oh, he says, "I was just kidding." And he started to leave, but he couldn't make it. He came back and he says, "Chuck, you know how you ruin every talk you ever make for me?" And I said, "No, I'd be interested." He says, "You take your coat off." I said, "Another good reason for you to go to Malibu." I said, "This is a pretty warm night, and I'm just liable to chuck out of this jacket any time. So you run on up there." Ah, he said, "Don't kid me." He said, "You don't take your coat off because you're hot. You take it off for the effect. I know, because I'm a public speaker, too." Now, not too long ago, he couldn't have gotten out of there with a tooth in his head. Every one of them would have been in his stomach because I'd have knocked him down there. But this time, what happened? I didn't have a project. My inside says the boy's hurting. The boy's hurting. I hope something comes out that'll give him a clue, you know? Now, this is the difference. People don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to. And when we come to see this, they can't hurt us. There's no way they can hurt us. because we know that all of God's kids are doing the best they can according to their light. That is, according to their understanding. When we know better, we do better. Now, a lot of people will say to me, oh, that's not true. I always knew better than to drink whiskey. No, you didn't. If you'd have known better, you wouldn't have drunk it. You know better now and you don't drink it, you see. I hated whiskey when I was a kid because I knew what it did. We were awful poor. And I worked from the time I was born. And I finally got enough money to send Sears Roebuck and get me a trench coat. You remember those trench coats? And God, I was proud of that trench coat. This was the greatest thing I'd, you know, you never had store-bought clothes. I had a 3.5-year-old brother, a brother that was 3.5 years older than I was, and I got his clothes. I never had any clothes of my own until I could buy them. And I got this beautiful trench coat, and I'm so proud. And one day my dad borrowed it without my permission. And he went to a labor meeting. And it came a bad storm, and we lived quite a little ways from the railroad. And he was coming home, and he got down 2 or 3 times in my trench coat and ruined it. You know? God, it liked to kill me. All the dough I'd saved, I put in that coat. And my dad had ruined it. Because he was drunk. You know? So I hated liquor. Just as I hated many other things in life. And I want to tell you this morning that I'd be afraid to hate the devil now. Because everything I ever hated in life, I've had to do. Now think about that. Everything I ever hated in other people in life, I've had to do myself. So we learn that that's not the right motive. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. And that's why it works. Now I'm going to close up shop. Again, I don't like to because I never feel like I've said anything. I don't think I've said anything yet that is worth coming down here for. I'd like to talk a long time, but you got to go home. Now, I believe with everything in me that we, the people right here in this room, and people like us all over the world, are the most fortunate segment of God's children who live on this earth. We are the most fortunate. There's nobody as fortunate as we are. Why? Because we have a terminal illness. And because our illness is progressive. And because the time comes when it's no longer possible for us to survive without an answer. And at long last, we come here. Hoping for one thing, that we might live till we die. Without having to drink. Because we want to spend that time rubbing out the record we've already written on the blackboard of life. And people, drunks who are not drunks, they hear the things we did, and we do them for sobriety. And we start making discoveries. Now, you can't discover before the fact. You discover after the fact. It has to happen before you can discover that it's happened. You see? So in 6 months, I discover that I'm sober and have been all the time. From the minute I said to myself, from the second I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. Until right now, I've never had a drink or a pill. So I discovered that after 6 months. And that was the first in the series of discoveries. The second one might have been another 6 or 8 or 10 months. And I discovered that something had actually happened in our household. The war seemed to be over. You know? They'd quit chasing me with a blue paper. And they're living like kittens. Yeah. And that was quite a discovery. Beautiful discovery. Some months later, I discovered I was still around the office, trying to clean up my desk. That boss of mine had come in and throw me through the window. But he didn't do it, because he recognized that something had happened. I didn't know it, but he did. And he didn't throw me through the window. And I'm still down there trying to clean up my desk, and business is good. Everything's going fine at the office. And what a beautiful discovery this is. And months go by again, and I discover that my state of being, my life, is much better than I ever dreamed it would be. Life is good. And that's a good discovery. And maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years have gone by now. And I discover that I'm never alone anymore. I have walked alone all my life. And I'm never alone anymore. I've got a God of my very own. And wherever I am, He is. Ah, what a discovery this is. This is the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over. And life begins. Life begins. It's fantastic. And it comes about just as simply and beautifully as attending these meetings and doing these things and sharing our love one with another, helping each other over the hurdles of life. And it comes about. And, of course, the great, great discovery includes the knowledge that freedom is an inside job. Freedom is an inside job. My own peace of mind and serenity of purpose depends on nothing but my own relationship with my very own God. Now, a few little things that I love so much. In the very early days, a kid came up to me after meeting, and he said to me, "Chuck, you know why it's so hard for us to find God?" And I thought, oh, my God, you know. I've got to sit here and listen to 2 hours discussion, you know, about finding God. And I didn't want to. I wanted to get out of there. But he had me trapped. And I had to say, no. Why is it so hard for us to find God? And he says, because He ain't lost. Because He ain't lost. Says, so you see, all we got to do is come back home. And we find He's always been there. We've been away. And then an old boy came up from Texas, incidentally. He was originally from Flint, Michigan. And his name was Big Smith. I haven't seen him for several years now. But Big Smith had done everything there is to do. Like running his car off of piers, you know, in the ocean. And through brick buildings and stuff. And he had one leg about that much longer than the other, and he walked like he was sneaking up on somebody. And he came into the group I was in that night, and he had a plaque under his arm, and he'd gotten it in a hospital right down here in Texas someplace. And he had this plaque under his arm, and he said to me, read this. And I read it. And it says, if you're not as close to God as you'd like to be, or as you once were, make no mistake. You're the one that moved. Smitty says, you see, all we got to do is come back home. And we find that God's always been there. We've been away. And the kid, again. And I saw him just the other day. I didn't know for years who had said this. This is 20-some years ago. And it was a Sunday night like this. And I'd talked. Highland Park. And three or four of us were standing in the middle of the room. And we were talking about how fortunate can a man be. How fortunate can a man be for a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk to have a life like mine, you know. How fortunate can you get? And one of these kids wasn't saying a thing. And pretty soon he looked at me and he said, Chuck, I'm ignorant. He says, I never read no books. He says, there's no sense in me reading books because I don't understand. He says, I don't know nothing about the Bible. I don't know nothing about God. But this no man can take away from me. When I do these simple things, one day at a time, to the best of my ability, I feel clean inside, and good things happen in my life. And when I could talk, I said, man, don't ever read no books. No time. This is what the book's written about. This is the thing itself. That we might feel clean inside and have good things happen as we go down the corridors of life. And so, again, when we come back home and get honest enough with ourselves to perform according to the best we know, one day at a time, something happens. And with Brother Lawrence, we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. Freedom is an inside job. Now, when we find ourselves, what are we supposed to do? Go about our Father's business. And we've got it laid out for us in the 12 steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. A lifetime job written right down there in the 12 steps. And so we go about our Father's business, trying to help his kids do things they need to have done because we want to. And he takes care of us. That's not my business. That's his business. My business is to do these things. It's his business to take care of me. And he's done an infinitely better job than I ever did. And I'm so grateful against him. And so I like to think of it every once in a while like this. And with this, I quit. You know, out on the coast, we call new people babies. I think you do down here, too. Back east, you call them pigeons. But a couple of thousand years ago, there's a guy around here. He had a few babies, too. He had 12 of them. You know, he followed him around, helped him. And he counseled him. And one of them was sort of a maverick. He might have been an alcoholic. Shouldn't say that down here in the Bible Belt. But he might have been an alcoholic. Because when he got caught with the goods on him, he lied out of it. You see? Now, maybe you didn't do that, but that sounds suspiciously like me. And so maybe because he was a maverick, the carpenter loved him better than anybody else. And it was about time for him to go, and so he called old Pete in. Now, a lot of people call him St. Peter, and I guess I should too. But I call him Old Pete, not because I don't respect him, but because I do. I love him. Love him to death. So I call him Old Pete. So he calls Old Pete in. And he says, Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yeah, Lord. And he says, tend my sheep. And he turned right around and asked him again. He says, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, Lord. He says, tend my sheep. And the third time he asked him, Peter, do you love me? Yea, Lord. And the third time he says, tend my sheep. Now it begins to appear that he meant tend my sheep. Now, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. We could take that third step this morning, and for just a minute, we could change it a little. We could say, we could say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, We tried to tend his sheep and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And, of course, it's in tending the sheep that we come to know the shepherd. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Remain standing, if you will. We'll close the meeting in the general way. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.